Our second case this morning is United States against Prather. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court, may it please the court, I am Major Dave Bennett, and together with Mr. Dwight Sullivan, I represent the appellant in this matter, Airman Stephen Prather. Our argument that Article 120 creates an unconstitutional burden shift has three main points. First, that the elements, definitions, and instructions pertaining to the offense that were provided by the military judge, both for the offense and the affirmative defense of consent, create an unconstitutional burden shift in that they require the defense to disprove an essential element of the offense, in this case that the alleged victim was substantially incapacitated. Second, that Article 120 creates an unconstitutional burden shift because it requires that the accused in raising the affirmative defense disprove an essential fact of the offense, in this case that the alleged victim did not consent. And third, that the military judge's instructions were deficient because of their sequential nature and because the military judge failed to instruct the panel members that they had to consider all of the evidence, even if all the evidence of consent, even if the accused did not prove the evidence by preponderance of, did not prove the facts by preponderance of the evidence. Article 120, as revised through the 2006 National Defense Authorization Act, as well as the findings instructions that were provided by the military judge, shifted the burden of disproving that the alleged victim was substantially incapacitated to the defense in order to raise the affirmative defense. Airman Prather was charged with a violation of Article 120C. In this case, that was charged as having sex with a person who was substantially incapacitated. So there's the Sex Act and the fact that the alleged victim was substantially incapacitated. The statute does not have a definition for the term substantially incapacitated. There's language in Article 120T14, which is the definition of consent, that talks about different instances where consent may not be given. That's the closest we get. But the military judge defined substantial incapacity.
Are there pieces of the statute that are constitutional in your view?
Your Honor?
Is there anything about the statute, this particular charge in the statute, that's constitutional?
With respect to this charge, our argument is that it's facially unconstitutional. So we are arguing that it can't be construed in a way that is constitutional.
But I mean, is there portions of the statute that are constitutional? Are you saying that the whole thing is problematic? Are you suggesting that someone can't be charged with aggravated sexual assault? Or are you suggesting that they can't be charged with aggravated sexual assault and have the consent be treated as an affirmative defense and instructed upon as it was in this case?
We are making, I guess, both arguments, Your Honor, but we are arguing that the crux, the central fact at issue in this offense is consent. So to the extent that the statute relieves the government of the burden.
Sure. So if you didn't have the defense, it's okay? If there's no affirmative defense?
No, Your Honor, we disagree. I think if I understand your question, you're asking me if you get rid of the affirmative defense, there's no problem.
But not for you. I mean, things have already occurred, but right. Could you just take the offense and have those elements? Are you saying those elements themselves are unconstitutional?
Yes, Your Honor, we are, because what we're saying is that the two elements, that there was a sex act and that the person was substantially incapacitated, are by themselves not constitutional, because the second element, the fact that the alleged victim was substantially incapacitated and could not consent, creates a presumption that there was no consent, which you need in order for there to be an offense in this case. In other words, that which makes this a crime is the fact that the alleged victim was incapacitated, could not, and therefore did not consent. That is the gravamen of the offense.
I mean, that whole concept of substantial incapacitation, meaning that a victim can't consent or by, as a matter of law, did not consent, that's nothing new. I mean, that's been the law, you know, for a very long time. This concept of children can't consent, passed out people can't consent.
Yes, Your
Honor. That's nothing new.
That's true, Your Honor. But I guess what is new is that the accused and is that the members are being instructed that consent is not an issue for them to consider unless it's raised as an affirmative defense.
Well, but that's cheating and saying cheating with a question, not cheating in some other way. So are you saying the elements in their own right are constitutional, full stop?
Is it constitutional as applied to a 9-year-old?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, I think there's a difference, though.
Is it constitutional as applies to a mentally handicapped person?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So it's not unconstitutional, full stop.
The problem is you're dealing with two adults in this case, and
well, no, now we're getting into as applied.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, it's still on the facial. What precludes Congress from passing a statute that says it's an offense for an individual to have sexual activity with a person who's substantially incapacitated?
Congress may not create an offense that relieves the government of its burden to prove an essential fact, Your Honor.
But the government has to prove that they're substantially incapacitated.
Right. The government has to prove that the victim is substantially incapacitated.
And as a matter of law, Congress has said that someone that is in that situation cannot consent. Cannot.
And there's the presumption. And I think the case law says, Your Honor, that the government can't be relieved of its burden to prove the fact that must be presumed.
Why is consent an element?
It's not an explicit element of the offense, Your Honor.
So, again, why can't Congress pass a law that says sexual activity with a person who's substantially incapacitated is an offense, period. And the judge instructs substantial incapacity means however the judge is going to instruct on that. It says nothing about consent one way or another. Why can't Congress do that?
Because, Your Honor, my understanding of the offense and really history of these offenses is that there has to be a lack of consent. So in other words, if you say substantial incapacitation, you are presuming.
What part of the Constitution bounds the Congress to that history? Binds the Congress to that history?
No part of the Constitution, Your Honor, but I believe the case law says that Congress cannot define an offense in a way that relieves the government of proving what is an essential fact.
But you don't disagree that the government has to prove that the putative victim falls into one of the categories under C2. You don't disagree that the government has to prove that, do you?
No, Your Honor.
I mean, I had thought that your problem or that the argument that you were making was that the real issue was that's all fine, well, and good, but because consent is put forth as an affirmative defense and because it's impossible to prove that someone who's incapacitated, to prove that someone consented unless you disprove the fact that they were incapacitated. I mean, I had thought that that was your argument.
That is certainly part of the argument, yes.
Do you think that's a better or a worse argument than the one?
I think that's a better argument. Yes, I do. I mean,
well, unless you want to pursue it further, or my colleagues want to pursue it further, why don't we assume, without you conceding, that C2 is constitutional, and then move on to the rest of the statute, either on its face or as applied?
Okay, Your Honor. The military judge defines substantially incapacitated as that level of mental or physical impairment due to alcohol, drugs, or otherwise that rendered the alleged victim unable to appraise the nature of the sexual conduct at issue, unable to decline participation in the sexual conduct at issue, and unable to physically communicate unwillingness to participate in the sexual conduct at issue. He defined consent, and this comes right out of the statute, as words or overt acts indicating freely given agreement by a competent person, and that a person cannot consent to something if the person is substantially incapacitated. So the way we see it, consent has these two elements that must be proven. One, that there are words that are spoken or acts that are taken to indicate freely given agreement, and two, that the person making those words or acts was not substantially incapacitated. So in this situation, the defense, and perhaps this gets to your point, Your Honor, in this situation, the defense must necessarily disprove that the alleged victim was substantially incapacitated in order to raise the affirmative defense.
How does this differ from Neal?
I think the big difference in this case, Neal, Your Honor, is that Neal focuses on the force element as opposed to the substantially incapacitated element. In this case...
Yes, and what? Yes. What's the constitutional distinction?
Well, it focuses on the accused, the actions of the accused, as opposed to the mental state of the alleged victim.
Yes, and?
And I think that the argument in our case is that the two are the are conflated, whereas in Neal...
Isn't that the argument in Neal?
It was the argument in Neal, Your Honor, but I think this court held that there are two separate issues, and in this case, they're not, because you're focusing, again, on the state of mind of the alleged victim, whether the alleged victim had the capacity to consent, as opposed to whether the alleged victim somehow consented to the force that was applied in a situation like Neal.
Does the defense require them to disprove the element absent the instructions? Or is it just that the defense is just no good unless if the government happens to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there is incapacity? Do you see the difference? Is it creating a burden or is it merely creating an empty defense if the government proves beyond a reasonable doubt?
Are you asking, Your Honor, if the defense can just sit back and do nothing?
No, I'm asking that, because the judge has to it's an affirmative defense. But if you took away, if the judge then said, I'm trying to disaggregate the parts here, we're inching you along the thing. If the judge then said, of course, the defendant's not required to prove anything here, has no burden whatsoever, the government has to prove beyond reasonable doubt each element of the offense, but you can consider whatever the defense has said in considering whether they've done that. Is that unconstitutional?
I think it is, Your Honor, because the judge has to instruct members that they must consider that evidence. I think you're getting toward...
Is this your must-may argument?
It is, Your Honor.
I don't want to do must-may. I want to just do... you can get the must-may, but just do what I... If you can deal with my hypothetical, and I will concede that you concede nothing by answering this. The judge affirmatively says the defendant has raised the issue of consent. You can consider whatever the defendant has said in determining whether the government has proven beyond a reasonable doubt its burden of demonstrating incapacity. Full stop. Is that unconstitutional? Understanding that the definition of incapacity is what it is.
You can consider the elements as they apply, the evidence as it applies to the elements that the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt. You still have, of course, the situation where by raising the affirmative defense, you have to disprove the substantial incapacity.
The judge has said the government has the burden of proving substantial incapacity. The defendant does not.
Okay. Then no. I guess you're – then no. So the burden is back on the government to prove that essential element. Yes. I don't think that's unconstitutional.
I'm just trying to get at what's the core constitutional issue, because there's a lot of moving parts here.
Yes, sir.
And the problem with humanic is saying something negative something is pretty much, that's what a trial is. The offense comes in and tries to prove something, and the defense tries to negatives it, whatever that means. So I'm trying to figure out what makes something unconstitutional as opposed to just a counterargument.
And I believe your hypos is probably somewhat similar to the scenario that exists when you take the bench book instruction as the instruction, supposedly the instruction which was read in this case.
Thank you for playing along.
Sorry it took me so long.
So if you have C2 is constitutional, which you're not conceding, but if C2 is constitutional, and if the definition of consent is constitutional, and the opportunity to have affirmative defense is constitutional, then, in your view, the unconstitutional part comes at that point if the defense is required to prove anything. If the government, if the judge puts the burden on the government, or if the statute put the burden on the government on the affirmative defense to disprove it, then we would not have unconstitutionality.
I think so, Your Honor, because in that situation, if I understand your hypothetical, the government is still required to prove the essential elements or essential facts of the offense.
Would you address the hypothetical, which you may have heard from the prior oral argument, that is, what about consent that is given beforehand if the consent is to engage in a sexual activity in which the person would be substantially incapacitated?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, I would say that that couldn't happen. You couldn't have that hypothetical because of the way the judge gave the instructions. In this case, he instructed the members that the consent had to take place at the time of the sex act. If you give me a moment, I can try to find
that. That's fine. We'll find that in the record.
So I don't think you can have that.
So that's not an issue in this case.
I don't think it is, Your Honor.
And was there any evidence in this case, aside from the instruction, was there any evidence of consent prior to? Was that at issue?
No, there was no evidence of consent prior to the actual time of sex act, no, that I'm aware of.
In order to raise the affirmative defense, what if anything does the appellant have to agree not to contest? What are they? Are they not contesting? Are they admitting? What are they doing?
In order to raise the affirmative defense, they are denying the criminal responsibility. They are not denying the objective acts, and we think this is sort of a significant point.
Is the objective act sex, or is the objective act sex with someone who's incapacitated?
The objective act is sex, and what they're denying and denying criminal responsibility is lack of consent. So they approve consent to deny lack of consent.
You just said it was sex, but now you're saying it's sex without consent?
The objective act is sex, Your Honor. The criminal act is having sex with someone who is not consenting. Lack of consent.
It's sex with someone who's substantially incapacitated.
Except that in this case, to raise the affirmative defense, Your Honor, you are proving consent, which denies lack of consent, which also gets to whether or not the person is substantially incapacitated.
Because I was just asking a simpler question, probably because I am a simpler thinker. Are they not contesting both elements or just the first element of the offense?
They are not contesting the first element of the offense, Your Honor.
Yeah. That's right. All I'm asking.
Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, Herman Prather did admit to having sex with the alleged victim.
Counsel, you have a further opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Before I begin, Chief Judge Efron, I would ask the court for permission to use a throat lozenge. I've had an incessant cough for the last few days.
You can use whatever you need for that. Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you have a glass of water up there as well?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
May it please the court. I'm Captain Naomi Portfield, and I, along with Mr. Gerald Cruz, have the privilege of representing the United States in this matter. While appellant may be displeased with his new burden under the revisions to the new Article 120, he has not and cannot establish that either as applied to the facts of his case or facially, that the statute is in fact unconstitutional. As a starting point, this court's analysis of the constitutionality of Article 120 cannot be viewed through the lens of the article as it existed prior to on October of 2007. Although the absence of consent was an element for the government.
Let's walk you backwards. We walked the appellant forwards. Let's walk you backwards.
Certainly.
How is it constitutional to say that the appellant has proven something by a preponderance, or demonstrated something by a preponderance of the evidence, and then say, but the government can disprove that by beyond a reasonable doubt? Isn't it something that's demonstrated by a preponderance of the evidence, or something that's more likely than not inherently a reasonable doubt?
Well, I think, Your Honor, the analysis, I guess I would disagree with the court's analysis, the presumption in that question.
It was the form of a noxious question, not analysis. Go ahead.
Well, in the government's interpretation of Article 120T16, which I assume you're referring to, since consent is not an element for the government to prove, or lack of consent, since it's not an element for the government to prove, the affirmative defense of consent essentially acts as a trigger. Where it provides a framework for the members to consider this evidence.
But if they've proven preponderance, consent by preponderance of the evidence, they've arguably demonstrated the capacity to consent by a preponderance of the evidence, and the capacity to consent depends on capacity.
Well, Your
Honor, so haven't they put into play by preponderance of the evidence that the person had the capacity to consent?
I think what the defense would be required to prove would be pointing to words and overt acts indicating a freely given agreement. They can introduce evidence, and that's what the members would consider, that type of evidence, whether the victim engaged in or spoke those words or engaged in those types of acts. And then they would further analyze the evidence. If they found that those words or overt acts existed by a preponderance of evidence, they would further analyze the evidence to determine whether those words or overt acts took place at the time of consent, at the time of substantial incapacitation or not, whether the consent was thus lawful, like the distinction that was made in Russell between evidence of consent and whether the consent was voluntary. Pardon me. The essential framework that the members are given, that's what T16 provides to the panel, the framework in which to analyze the evidence.
Counsel, is that what the statute says in response to Judge Baker's question? That the statute says the accused has the burden of approving the affirmative defense by a preponderance of the evidence. What's the affirmative defense?
The affirmative defense of consent, Your Honor, that the victim engaged in words or overt acts indicating a freely given agreement.
If that's proved by a preponderance, then why isn't the case over at that point in terms of the government's burden with respect to proving the underlying offense beyond a reasonable doubt?
To that end, to the extent that this creates an impossible burden for the government, it would essentially direct a verdict, and the appellant would be acquitted. If anything, it harms the government's case and not the appellant's, if this were the mathematical equation proposed by the appellant.
So is the Section 16 unconstitutional with respect to, or just nonsensical with respect to the burden that it then provides for the government, or do those words have meaning that the government seeks to infuse into the statute now?
Your Honor, as a starting point, we would certainly not concede that the statute is either unconstitutional nor nonsensical. Yet, I would acknowledge, however, that it is at first glance confusing. But in looking at the statute and examining it, even in the context of these facts, and walking through the instructions that the military judge provided, consent is not an issue in the case as a starting point. It's not a burden. The lack thereof is not a burden for the government to prove.
The thing I don't understand about you saying that is that the consent is not an issue in the case or it's not a problem in the statute is based on the way that substantial incapacity is defined under subsection C2, right? And then the statute goes on to say that consent is an affirmative defense, and talking about that. And then it goes on under 14 to talk about what consent means, and it goes on to then go on to say a person cannot consent, and basically tracks the language that would make something constitute an offense under C2. So how, if someone is charged under C2, do they have available to them a defense of consent without having to disprove that the person was not substantially incapable of understanding, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the things that make it an offense in the first place?
Well, my answer to that question would be two parts, Your Honor. First, I do think that the language, the similarity in language between C2 and the definition in T14 is what makes the statute confusing. However, in looking at it as applied to the facts of this case, the affirmative defense can be construed in a way that only presents itself in a narrow set of circumstances.
But the way that they were instructed in this case is they talk about substantial incapacity, they talk about consent as an affirmative defense, the next words out of the judge's mouth, a person cannot consent if they're substantially incapacitated, which on its face appears to be giving them slightly different, basically saying, but that defense is not available.
Well, Your Honor, the way that it's instructed would appear to be that the consent cannot be given at the time of the substantial incapacitation.
So are we back then to the argument made by the government in the prior case that you can have consent in point in time A, later substantial incapacity, and that that's not, doesn't fall under C2?
If two airmen get together and agree to get drunk and then have sex, then the affirmative defense of consent would squarely fit under those circumstances. But in any event, Your Honor, the burden of proving substantial incapacity remains on the government. It starts with the government, it ends with the government. So to that end, the affirmative defense would essentially become illusory, and it would not be shifting. I apologize. It would not be shifting to the defense to prove.
Let's assume for a second that I don't find the statute to be confusing. I find to be those subsections to be very clear and apparently problematic. You know, how do we square those? Other than the example that you've just given, even assuming that we would accept that saved the statute from being facially unconstitutional, even if we accepted the notion that that consent can't be obviated by later incapacity, even if those were the facts in this case, can you give any other situation where an appellant, a defendant, could raise the defense of consent under a C2 charge without having to disprove that the individual is substantially incapacitated?
Well, Your Honor,
any example, and I want an example other than the one that you and the government in the prior case gave before.
Well, Your Honor, I guess my answer to that question would be under the doctrine of constitutional avoidance and Salerno, I don't think that the government would be required to anticipate, and even in Winship, I don't think that the government would be required to anticipate and disprove all of the possible scenarios in which the affirmative defense of consent would apply.
Well, I'm not asking the government to do that. I'm asking the government to do something much smaller and much, potentially much simpler, since you think that the statute is merely confusing and not problematic, which is give me an example where an appellant can raise a defense of consent under a C2 charge violation under C2 without having to disprove that the victim was substantially incapacitated as defined in the statute.
Well, Your Honor, I will take the facts of this case. Again, if the burden to prove, if taking your point, Your Honor, that consent cannot, a person cannot consent when they are substantially incapacitated, and the military judge's instruction in this case. If the burden, and it is, to prove substantial incapacitation is on the government, to start with, to end with, remains on the government, then the defense is never required to disprove those elements. That point was reiterated here through the military judge's instructions, both at the beginning and at the end.
But the members were instructed on an affirmative defense of consent.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they were also instructed that a person who's substantially incapacitated can't consent. So how
at
would
at the time, yes, Your Honor.
No, that's not what it says. That's what the government is arguing. It's not what the statute says, and it's not what the government military judge said. How would the appellant in this case have shown what they needed to show under the statute for its affirmative defense without also showing that the individual wasn't substantially incapacitated?
Your Honor, I guess
I'm just asking, how would they do that?
Your Honor,
when it says, as a matter of law, that if they're substantially incapacitated, they can't consent, how is that a meaningful defense? How is that a defense that doesn't make them disprove an element of the government's case in every scenario other than the one that the government gave us prior, where there was consent followed by subsequent incapacity in the government's position that consent would continue?
Your Honor, I think the court's question presumes that the affirmative defense of consent is the only available consent, is the only available defense. And that
no,
it
that's
is.
Not what I'm asking. I'm asking you to give me an example under this statute with that defense. It's in this statute, and I'm not assuming that it's the only defense. There's plenty of defenses to be made in any particular case. I'm asking you about the one that's in the statute that we're here about today.
Well, Your Honor, the government isn't prepared to offer additional examples other than what we've argued here.
I understand the government's position. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's take the case before us, and please amplify if I've not accurately described. There may be cases out there of people agreeing beforehand to engage in sex where both are not, one or more are not in, are capable of understanding what's going on. But the typical case that we've seen in our court, and I believe this is one of them, is where the two people engage in sexual activity. The sex act itself is not at issue, but at issue is one person saying the victim consented, and the alleged victim saying, "I was drunk." That is, in the words of the statute, "I was not capable of appraising the nature of the sexual conduct at issue. I wasn't capable of physically communicating an unwillingness." Those are that's the evidence in the case. In that case, who has the burden of, first of all, raising the defense? Does anyone have the burden, or does the judge look at the evidence and decide whether the issue of consent has been raised by the evidence?
Well, Your Honor, in looking at the statute, it doesn't invoke any requirement that the decision be made by the military judge.
In this case, who made the decision in this case?
The panel.
Now, who made the decision that the instruction was going to be given?
The military judge, Your Honor.
So he must have found enough evidence in the case to raise the issue of consent.
Yes, Your Honor.
And who in this case had the burden of determining whether the person was, in the terms of the defense, substantially incapable of appraising the nature of the sexual conduct at issue?
That would be the government, Your Honor.
Had that burden?
The government had the burden to prove that the victim was substantially incapacitated.
But who had the burden of proving the defense of consent? Didn't the judge say that the defense had that burden?
Yes, Your Honor.
And wouldn't that burden include addressing the issue of whether the person was or was not substantially incapable?
Your Honor, I think that the defense's burden would include evidence that goes to the description outlined by this court in United States versus Neal of the words or overt acts that would indicate the freely given agreement.
This case doesn't involve the statute that was at issue in Neal. Neal was a force case.
Certainly, yes, Your Honor.
This is a substantial incapacity case.
Yes, Your Honor. The cases do involve different aspects of Article 120.
And where did the judge say that in assessing the affirmative defense, it is the burden on the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person was substantially incapable of appraising the nature of the sexual conduct at issue? Did the judge put that burden on the government for purposes of assessing the defense?
What the government, the military judge did not use those words. However, the military judge did indicate that the burden to prove substantial incapacitation was on the government.
As to the element of the offense.
I apologize, Your Honor.
The judge gave that instruction as to the element of the offense. I'm talking about the defense right now.
Yes, Your Honor. As to the element of the offense, but then the military judge went on to say that the defense is never required to prove his innocence, to disprove the government's case. And so the instructions were there to make clear to the panel that the appellant was never required to prove his innocence.
I understand that. Did the judge tell anybody who was required to address this aspect of the defense? A person cannot consent to sexual activity if the person is substantially incapable of appraising the nature of the sexual conduct at issue. What did the judge say in terms of who had the burden there?
Your Honor, the government would argue that in reading the instructions as a whole, it was made clear to the panel that the government had the burden to prove substantial incapacitation throughout the proceedings. With regard to your question specifically on whether the military judge said with regard to this portion of the article, there was no specific reference to who had the burden to prove that.
But didn't the judge instruct that the burden of proof with respect to the affirmative defense rested with the defense? by a preponderance of the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why wouldn't the members reasonably believe that it was the defense burden to address this issue of consent with respect to being substantially incapable?
Well, for two reasons. One, Your Honor, the court, the trial judge, indicated repeatedly that the burden to prove the elements of substantial incapacitation remained with the government and that the defense was not required to disprove the government's case. And two, because the military judge instructed that evidence of consent could be used for all purposes, including to determine whether the government met its burden to prove the elements.
Okay, thank you.
Appellant generally argued, and without reiterating the points that we made in our briefs, debated about the language that was used by the military judge, but the United States maintains that the military judge made clear in reading his instructions as a whole under Humanic, Martin, Neal, Russell, that he made clear what evidence they were to consider in determining whether the government met its burden.
Do you disagree that this would be as much fun as we have on these 120 cases, that life would be a lot easier if they just made some changes to the statute along the lines foreshadowed perhaps in the Chief Judge's opinion in Neal?
No, Your Honor. I do think that the field could use a more practical statute. I would certainly agree with you on that.
Why doesn't the government go to the Department of Defense and ask them to have that happen?
Off the record?
I'm sorry. I don't mean to put you in that. We'll ask Mr. Bruce to. Sorry, that was not a fair question.
Is the last phrase of T-16 surplusage?
Well, Your Honor, we wouldn't say that it was surplusage. We would say that, in any event, it would not operate to the harm of appellant. If it was deemed to be an impossible burden for the government, it would not operate to the harm of appellant. It would essentially direct a verdict. If there are no further questions from the court, can I briefly conclude?
Well, I'd just like to follow up on that. If, in fact, the defendant then proves his burden by a preponderance of the evidence, I believe you just said that would mean a directed verdict. Why, then, is that language not surplusage as far as the government's ability to come back and prove it beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, Your Honor, I guess to clarify, if that's what I indicate, if that were the court's view, if ultimately they found that the burden was impossible and there was no way for the government to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt, if the court deemed that the government's burden would be impossible, then it would, in order to the benefit of the appellant. Does that answer your question?
Why does that necessarily inure to the benefit of the appellant? All the lawyers who have looked at this have struggled as to what that means. If we're dealing with a court-martial panel, why isn't it just as reasonable to assume that a court-martial panel would first make a decision as to preponderance of the evidence and then follow the judge's instructions and reconsider that and then make a decision beyond a reasonable doubt and have an inconsistent verdict that no one would ever know about?
Well, I see that my time has expired.
You can answer that question.
Certainly. Your Honor, I don't think the statute as written requires a reconsideration. I think it's merely analyzing the government's evidence to rebut the affirmative defense of consent for the first time, because consent is originally not an element. It's only triggered by the evidence that's raised from the defense.
And did the judge give an instruction to that effect?
I think when you read the instructions as a whole, that's a reasonable assumption.
You may briefly conclude.
Yes, Your Honor. Despite the controversy surrounding the revisions to Article 120 at first glance, an in-depth constitutional analysis presents no basis upon which to find the statute unconstitutional, either facially or as applied to the facts of appellant's case. For these reasons, we ask that you affirm the findings and the sentence.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your appearance today.
Does the defense have rebuttal?
Your Honor, I did just want to point out that on Joint Appendix page 89, there's that piece of the judge's instruction that makes it clear that there must be consent at the time of the sex act. And to answer what I think your question was a few moments ago, Judge Heffron, who has the burden of proving substantial incapacitation based on the judge's instructions? We would say that that is the disproving substantial incapacitation based on the instructions. We would say that that was the defense, and that is because the way the instructions flowed in this case, the military judge spoke of consent being raised as an affirmative defense, described what consent means, and then followed that by saying that a person cannot consent to sexual activity if that person is substantially incapacitated. So the logical conclusion for the members was that in order to prove consent, the defense had the burden of disproving substantial incapacitation on the part of the alleged victim. That was a burden that the defense had to carry by preponderance of the evidence, and it was one that they simply could not carry without taking that extra step of disproving substantial incapacitation. There are no further questions, Your Honor. We would ask this honorable court to set aside the findings and the sentence in this case. Dismiss charge of specification of prejudice.
Thank you, counsel. And we appreciate the appearance of both counsel today and your submissions. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 10 a.m. on Friday, in which we will convene a ceremonial session to mark the 100th anniversary of this courthouse.
All rise.